The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It is Friday, the last show of the week. And make sure you follow through on your Friday assignment, as I've been stressing the last few weeks, to send us an email over the weekend or maybe later today. You can send your comments, your feedback, your questions, your suggestions, your personal information as far as how you listen, when you listen, where you listen from. Send those comments, please, will you, to td@kpcg.fm. We've not only been going through quite a few of those comments on the air, but we're now starting to get some comments from people who say they enjoy the comments, and they really find them to be quite inspiring. So if those keep rolling in through the weekend, hopefully early next week, we can get back into some of your thoughts. On today's program, we're going to pick up on a couple of themes that we spent some time on yesterday. The continuing protests, or as the Portland Police Department called it last night, the rioting. The rioting, it continues following the election of Donald Trump on Tuesday, or I guess early Wednesday morning. And we'll talk more, too, about the media coverage of these events, the rioting and following the presidential election that, of course, shocked the liberal leftist major media. I said yesterday, don't expect the media to be contrite or humble following their spectacular failures during the course of this campaign. Well, as it happens, we did find, shockingly, we found one commentary in the media, one individual, one journalist, who actually did express a good measure of humility and contrition following the election, and he suggested that others in the media follow in that example. So we'll spend some time on that coming up in the second segment. We'll also talk later on in this segment about, speaking of media coverage, we'll talk about Donald Trump's meeting, his awkward and some would say uncomfortable meeting with the President of the United States, President Barack Obama. That happened yesterday afternoon, I think, there in the White House. But first, the rioting in Portland. This is from CNN International.
This is breaking news happening right now. This appears to be, I don't know if it's tear gas, it could be smoke, but some kind of device now being used by police to disperse the crowds, we think, there on Portland. These demonstrations have been going on across the country overnight. In Portland specifically, again, police are saying they're more than demonstrations. They are riots because of the damage to property and also the danger posed to law enforcement. Things have been thrown at them.
That's from CNN International, and he went on from there to discuss with a couple of panelists why these events were happening, and all three of them pretty much justified the events, as journalists have been known to do, saying that, well, had Hillary Clinton won the election, it would be the same thing from the other side. And after all, these are expressions of free speech, and that's something that we're here to support, as if they would cover it that way. If the Tea Party took to the streets and started burning down buildings and throwing objects at police officers, you can only imagine. They searched far and wide. I mean, you saw it even with the Trump rallies months ago. Far and wide, to just find one incident, one small, tiny incident that they could then use to say that the whole movement is, as I covered with you yesterday, the whole movement is angry, violent, racist, homophobic, and on and on and on and on it goes. 29 people were arrested. Like the police department says up there in Portland. I mean, this is not a demonstration. This is a full-scale riot. And the police came out and called these demonstrators anarchists, as they should be called. I was kind of stunned by one of the tweets coming from Donald Trump. The one he sent the other night, the first night of all these protests, he said that, where did he say this? Now professional protesters, he said, incited by the media, are protesting. Very unfair. He said that the media is inciting this, which is basically the point that we made yesterday. And then he sends this tweet out just a couple of hours ago. He says he loves the fact that the small groups of protesters have passion for our great country. We will all come together and be proud. Who knows why he's changed his tune and now points out that they're passionate, that they're exercising their free speech rights. Who knows why the change in tone, but he hit it right the first time. The media's there inciting it, for sure. In the case of these commentators on CNN, they're justifying it. They're justifying violence. We've seen this all play out before. Give them space. Give them some space to riot, to destroy, to speak their minds. And they're doing it. And the media, helpfully, is there excusing this lawless behavior. Last night I was watching this. This is a little more of a broad sweep, not just about the angry protests, but that's included in this report as well. It was what played here on the news in the UK. This is from ITV, and it's a fairly long excerpt here, a couple minutes, but I thought you'd appreciate, again, just getting the UK's perspective on what's happening after or following the election of Donald Trump.
These were protests in cities across America. Not large, but passionate and disruptive.
Not my president!
A sign that there are many Americans who will not easily accept the reality of a Donald Trump presidency. In Manhattan, they converged on the Fifth Avenue skyscraper, where the president-elect lives and works. The defiance and the outrage of demonstrators bolstered by the fact that Hillary Clinton secured more votes than Trump in this election, even though she lost under the Electoral College system. And in Washington, too, there was a march. Many in minority communities telling me they fear that hate and intolerance will be unleashed across America.
This is a protest against them, and we stand for democracy.
Can you ever accept him as your president?
Absolutely not. That's why I'm here.
These nationwide protests may be just beginning. The anger on the political left here is immense and could easily build towards inauguration. That is still 70 days away, meaning the transition could be punctuated by anger and disturbances on the streets of this politically fractured nation. We haven't seen Donald Trump since the early hours of yesterday morning, when he promised to bind America's wounds. But from a candidate who promises to deport millions of undocumented workers, prosecute his former opponent, and potentially ban Muslims from entering the US, it can be no surprise there are many who are skeptical that this will be a magnanimous presidency. Later today, he will be here in Washington to meet with President Obama. The transfer of power will then be underway. A supremely uncomfortable moment, given that Trump has promised to dismantle Obama's reforms. And of course, with Trump's questioning of the president's birthplace, there is a very personal backstory to their awkward relationship.
And if he wasn't born in this country, which is a real possibility, I'm not saying it happened, I'm saying it's a real possibility, much greater than I thought 2 or 3 weeks ago, then he has pulled one of the great cons in the history of politics.
Even as some protested last night, millions of others are exhilarated at the idea of a maverick taking power. So Trump has his army of supporters as well.
That's from the ITV News from last night. It's a little bit behind some of the events that have transpired since. Of course, the meeting between President Obama and President-elect Trump, which we'll get to here in just a second. But you can see what they're spotlighting, all of this anger, this violence. And as that particular reporter, Robert Moore is his name, he said it's just beginning and that this could easily build. He's right about that. And then, of course, there's a lot of attention brought to just the vast differences between these two. But coming back to the violence and the way that the media is reporting on this, or in some cases simply not reporting, certainly not so much when it is violent. You know, you have to have the police department there saying, look, this is not a peaceful demonstration. They're destroying property. 29 people were arrested in Portland just last night. 29. Not a peaceful demonstration. These are professional protesters, as we've seen over and over and over again. And it's brought on by incitement coming from the media and also politicians. For sure, there's plenty of blame to go around. Here's how the New York Times reported on it yesterday. Thousands of people, this is about the protest from the first night, thousands of people across the country marched, shut down highways, burned effigies, and shouted angry slogans on Wednesday night to protest the election of Donald Trump as president. The demonstrations, fueled by social media, continued into the early hours of Thursday. The crowd swelled as the night went on, but remained mostly peaceful. Mostly peaceful. That's the way the major media reports it. It's always mostly peaceful when it's brought on by the left. Always. And then, of course, the protests themselves, these mostly peaceful protests themselves, they spring from a long American tradition of free speech. Again, imagine them providing this kind of cover for the Tea Party. They, as I say, will go far and wide to find one tiny little incident, or to even make them up, to find the whole movement guilty if it's coming from the right. Such hypocrisy and a double standard. And you can see why 2/3 of Americans don't trust the media. And you would think it would, all of these spectacular failures, as I say, you would think they'd show a little more humility. But they don't, except for this one that I'll read in the next segment. But for the most part, like the New York Times writes today, the rage of white Christian America. Again, it gets back to race. It all gets back to race, even if it's not grounded in facts. That doesn't stop them. You can look at the numbers. You can look at the demographics, as I said yesterday. But that doesn't stop them. These are angry white people who are rallying behind a bigot for their leader. That's what they've been saying it all over the news. And the moderators just nod and say, all right, thank you for the debate. And then the riots spring forth. And then the coverage is that, well, I mean, it would be happening if it was the other side too. So it's not really that big of a deal. We're not inciting anything. It's race, or in some cases, it's sexism. The New York Times has both. You pick which one you want. I mean, girls can be anything, just not president. That's the headline of an opinion piece. Yes, girls, you can do anything, but not president, because the men are out to get you. This is the New York Times, an opinion piece this morning. She was representative, Clinton, that is. She was representative of those things in a country where the average person finds it easier to pair words like president and executive with male names, and words like assistant and aide with female names. She represented female power in spite of the reality that a woman's likability is inverse to her leadership status. That is, we like her less the more she rises, while the opposite is true for men. What kind of a alternate universe is this woman living in, the author of this piece? In a world where men have been under attack, an assault. There's a conspiracy against fathers. Coming from every direction. It's never enough, is it? It's never enough for those out there regularly practicing racial politics or feminist politics. It's never, never, never enough. It says her loss is not as simple as gender, but as one little girl put it through tears, why doesn't anybody like a girl president? That's a New York Times columnist concluding her piece by quoting from a little girl. It's amazing. Well, on the other side, you've got quite a lot of celebrating. So many talking heads on radio, TV, just absolutely giddy that finally we can roll back all of these failed policies of Barack Obama. I noticed one of them, Rush Limbaugh, the other day. I think this was from a couple of days ago. He said that the result of this election shows that America finally spoke up and told liberalism and big government to take a hike. All the big government. Americans are sick of it. I think his take on this might be a little bit off. Is this the end of liberalism? You go back and read America Under Attack. Or go back before that to an article my father wrote at the end of 2006. When a lot of Democrats came to power. I mean, it is true, as I covered with you yesterday. There's a lot of elections where Democrats haven't performed very well on the state level, on the federal level as well. But on the whole, like my father brought out in that article, San Francisco values is winning. No matter the political party, is this the end of big government? Is a Donald Trump administration the end of big government? Well, that's what some would have you believe. Were they even listening to his acceptance speech the other night? We played this for you on Wednesday. This is clip 3.
We are going to fix our inner cities and rebuild our highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, hospitals. We're going to rebuild our infrastructure, which will become, by the way, second to none. And we will put millions of our people to work as we rebuild it.
Translation, big government is going to get bigger. We're going to fix all the inner city problems. Going to rebuild the highways, the bridges, the tunnels, and we're going to put millions of Americans to work to complete these projects. Best in the world. I mean, how different, really? How different is this from what President Obama was saying coming into office in 2009?
The state of our economy calls for action, bold and swift, and we will act. Not only to create new jobs, but to lay a new foundation for growth. We will build the roads and bridges, the electric grids and digital lines that feed our commerce and bind us together. We will restore science to its rightful place and wield technology's wonders to raise healthcare's quality and lower its cost. We will harness the sun and the winds and the soil to fuel our cars and run our factories. And we will transform our schools and colleges and universities to meet the demands of a new age. All this we can do. All this we will do.
That's President Obama at his 2009 inauguration. And, of course, when he came in, this is coming right off of the economic crisis of 2008. He actually had money, quite a lot of money, to spend on these kinds of projects. Of course, when I say money, I mean, you know, the fake kind that they print or they borrow. But it was something like $1 trillion further that we went into debt with all these bailout programs to spend on infrastructure This is something we can do. This is something we will do. And here we are 8 years on. Where'd the money go? How many of these projects got done? Donald Trump comes in now and you see the same infrastructure aging and in decline. And the assurances and the promises, and I'm sure he'll come up with plenty of money from out of nowhere, just like Barack Obama did. And then how much of it goes to the special interest groups? How much of it goes to the lobbyists? How much of it goes to those who helped him get elected? It's the same old, same old. I played for you, I think this was about a month ago, we had a program on big government where Mr. Trump in one of the, I don't think it was a debate as much a town hall kind of discussion, where he was talking about all the great functions of the federal government to provide health care, education, and so many, many, many other things. So many big things. He can do it all, and it's going to be second to none. All those infrastructure projects, building up the military, building up the wall, protecting the working class from jobs that are going overseas. He's going to do away with Obamacare, but then he's got something to put in its place, no doubt. He's got to rescue all of these failing social insurance programs. He made a promise a month and a half or two ago about government-funded maternity leave for women. He's promising to subsidize out-of-home child care. He's going to use government. He's going to use big government to interfere with free markets and to impose tariffs. We're going to talk more about trade next week. His views on trade. But is this the end of big government? When have you heard Donald Trump at any point in this campaign season tell you that he's talked about the incomprehensible level of debt? But what has he said? What plan has he put forward that in any way suggests that the national debt is going to be reduced? He's in his office, as so many before him were in office, based upon big promises he's made about an ever-expanding, bigger government than ever before. Big government's about to get bigger. It's about to get bigger. I'm not going out on a limb on that. That's been the history. You think those in Congress, Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan, and all those that are now rallying together, they've got a majority. They've got the president. They've got the Senate. They've got the House of Representatives. They control so many of the governorships around the country, the state houses. What a perfect time. What a perfect opportunity to reduce the standard of living, to draw down on that debt. What a perfect time to say, hey, this reckless, out-of-control spending has got to stop. We've got to do it for our children and our grandchildren. You think that's going to happen anytime soon? Well, let's watch. Let's see what happens. Let's see what they do. You don't rebuild highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, hospitals, infrastructure, and put millions and millions of Americans to work without spending trillions and trillions of dollars at the same time. And so the question is, where does that money come from? Was this election really about American people? The citizenry finally stepping forward, finally speaking up and saying that is an end to big government. Well, to be sure, a lot of those who voted for Donald Trump are no doubt sick of many of President Obama's policies, nationalized health care and such. But do you really feel like a majority of Americans are fed up with the out-of-control spending? so many of Americans spin themselves the same way. It's out of control. Debt-laden living. It's just the way we are. We said yesterday that these candidates, they're just a reflection of the populace. And when I get into the next segment, there's at least one journalist who's somewhat more contrite and humble than he was before the election. Well, look at a verse where God says to us, you've got to look at yourselves. You've got to humble yourselves and confess your sins, your problems, your weaknesses. That's what God tells us to do. Well, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. Let me just, before we cut away to break here, talk briefly about this meeting that President Obama had yesterday with the president-elect. And I mean, if you are a political junkie, and hopefully I'm not, there's much more to think about and to concentrate on. But if you're a political junkie, you had to have looked at this meeting and, well, what? I mean, what are the chances? The election, if the election wasn't shocking enough on Tuesday, seeing these two men sitting in the same room, Donald Trump had tweeted months ago that Barack Obama was the worst president in the history of the United States. And President Obama had said 3 days ago that this was a man who was temperamentally unfit for the office of president. I mean, you can write a fiction story better than this. This is from the press briefing that the two of them had yesterday, clip 5.
Well, I just had the opportunity to have an excellent conversation with President-elect Trump. It was wide-ranging. We talked about some of the organizational issues in setting up a White House. We talked about foreign policy. We talked about domestic policy. And as I said last night, my number one priority in the coming 2 months is to try to facilitate a transition that ensures our president-elect is successful.
That's from President Obama yesterday at the press briefing he had there together with Donald Trump. Several pictures have been circulated, and again, quite a few commentators, like the one from ITV we played earlier, that said how uncomfortable and awkward this meeting would be, and yet it, I guess based upon what they said, it turned out to go fairly well. But keep in mind, again, what President Obama was saying out on the campaign trail just on Monday. This is Monday of this week, clip 6.
Donald Trump is uniquely unqualified to be president. He is temperamentally unfit to be commander-in-chief.
That's from Fayetteville, North Carolina, Monday. This one here is from Philadelphia, also same day, clip 7.
More than his policies or his plans, though. Throughout his campaign, Donald Trump has shown utter contempt for the values that make this nation great.
He has utter contempt for America's values. He is uniquely unqualified, this man. And he's temperamentally unfit. But they got together yesterday and had an excellent and productive meeting. Here's more from yesterday's briefing, clip 8.
Most of all, I want to emphasize to you, Ms. President-elect, that we now are going to want to do everything we can to help you succeed, because if you succeed, then the country succeeds. Please.
Well, thank you very much, President Obama. This was a meeting that was going to last for maybe 10 or 15 minutes, and we were just going to get to know each other. We had never met each other. I have great respect. The meeting lasted for almost an hour and a half, and it could have, as far as I'm concerned, it could have gone on for a lot longer. We really, we discussed a lot of different situations, some wonderful and some difficulties. I very much look forward to dealing with the president in the future, including counsel. He explained some of the difficulties, some of the high-flying assets, and some of the really great things that have been achieved. So, Mr. President, it was a great honor being with you, and I look forward to being with you many, many more times in the future. Thank you, sir.
After that meeting, he tweeted out, Donald Trump did, that it was just a fantastic day meeting President Obama for the first time, and how that the meeting was productive and good. There was great chemistry. His wife loved meeting with Mrs. Obama, and so there's just love all the way around. Josh Earnest said yesterday at the press briefing that yeah, it was a little less awkward than some might have expected. They hit it off. As Mr. Trump brought out, I mean, it was supposed to be 10-15 minutes, I guess, and it went on for 90 minutes. So what does this indicate? Well, who knows? Who knows? Maybe it is just all about the transition. Maybe they are just saying all the right things in public. But I suspect that these two, again, these two probably have a lot more in common than most people realize. We'll see early on in the administration of Donald Trump just how many of Barack Obama's policies are rolled back. We'll see. We'll find out soon enough. And we'll talk more, as I said, next week about what a future Trump administration, it's not quite in office yet, but these next 70 days, I'm sure, will be telling who he appoints, what kind of an administration he sets up, and then, of course, once the inauguration is here, then what they set out to do in those early days of the presidency. But going back to Donald Trump and his history, I mean, this is a lifelong, big-spending, liberal leftist in so many ways. And so how much do these two have in common? Who knows? He's going to be leaning on President Obama for counsel and said it was a great honor there being with him. You wouldn't expect the two of them to just trash each other publicly. I'm not saying that's the way it should have been at all. I mean, it was good to see them, given what they were saying just a few days earlier. It was good to see them saying those kinds of things. But given all that had been said for the 19 months leading up to this point, there's consequences for that kind of language and those kinds of statements of inciting protesting violence and so on. There's lots of people out on the streets of America that I think when they heard President Obama and others talking about how temperamentally unfit and how uniquely unqualified Donald Trump is or was, however you look at it, I think they're convinced. They believe that. There's lots of wounds that aren't going to go away, though, after a few pleasantries, you know, between one another. The division, as I covered with you yesterday, is so deep. The nation, the country, the people, the political parties, the races, we're all so divided. We're so divided. And Jesus, as we covered with you, said that a kingdom that is divided cannot stand. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget about your weekend assignment. That would be to email the program at td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
So congratulations to Will Ron, who writes at CBS News, for admitting that, yeah, we've been unbearably smug, we in the press, and the times that we're in call upon us to be more humble. He says here again, this is CBS, he says the mood in the Washington press corps is bleak, and deservedly so. It shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone that, with a few exceptions, we were all tacitly or explicitly with her, which has led to a certain anguish in the face of Donald Trump's victory. More than that, and more importantly, we also missed the story. After having spent months mocking the people who had a better sense of what was going on. So they were totally in the tank, and they totally missed the story. They totally missed what was going on. He says this is all symptomatic of modern journalism's great moral and intellectual failing, its unbearable smugness. Had Hillary Clinton won, there'd be the winking, we did it feeling in the press, a sense that we were brave and called Trump a liar and saved the Republic. Will says so much for that. The audience for our glib analysis and contempt for much of the electorate, it turned out, was rather limited. This was particularly true when it came to voters, the ones who turned out by the millions to deliver not only a rebuke to the political system, but also the people who cover it. Trump knew what he was doing when he invited his crowds to jeer and hiss the reporters covering him. They hate us and have for some time. It was really pretty remarkable when you'd watch these campaign rallies that always had large groups of people, lots of people, thousands of people turning up. And then, of course, the press corps that followed him around and set up all of their cameras and their microphones. And then Trump, during his stump speeches, talking about how dishonest the media was, so dishonest and always lying, and he'd just point at them right there from the podium. And the crowds at his rallies, they loved it. They loved it. And as Will Ron brings out here at CBS, they missed the story. They missed the whole story here and just spent months rather mocking the people at those rallies and mocking Trump. And yet Trump was on to something. It says here, can you blame them? Talking about those that hate the media. Journalists love mocking Trump supporters. We insult their appearances. We dismiss them as racist and sexist. We emote on Twitter about how this or that comment or policy makes us feel one way or the other, and yet we reject their feelings as invalid. We diagnose them as racist in the way Dark Age clerics confused medical problems with demonic possession. Journalists, well, a little further down here, says, you'd think that Trump's victory, the one we all discounted too far in advance, would lead to a certain newfound humility in the political press. But of course, that's not how it works. To us, speaking broadly, our diagnosis was still basically correct. The demons were just stronger than we realized. I mean, you'd think that this would cause us to be humble or to at least reflect on where we got it wrong. But instead, it's just like I said yesterday, don't expect them to come out and to be contrite and all those things. Instead, now, well, they just see that the demons, there's so many more of them than they actually realized. And so Will Ron goes on to say here, this is all a white lash, you see. Trump voters are racist and sexist. Never mind the stats, as I've been telling you. This is the story now. We lost. We got it way wrong. We totally missed it. It went right over our heads. But never mind that. Now the story is that, well, there's just more racist and there's more sexist than we ever thought. Tuesday night's outcome, this is his, again, this commentary. Tuesday night's outcome was not a logic-driven rejection of a deeply flawed candidate named Clinton. No, no. It was a primal scream against fairness, equality, and progress. Let the new tantrums commence. And so that's what we've seen. And I've played some of them for you this week. Yesterday in particular. I mean, here you had two commentators. One acting like a child. One hurling insults. One who talked over the other one. One who said, I'm not going to listen to you. I don't even know who you are. And then you had the other one who tried to maintain his composure and make a few points when he wasn't being talked over. One who was acting like an adult. And which one of those two, do you suppose, writes for the New York Times? Well, you know the answer. He says here that the explainers and data journalists so frequently get things hilariously wrong never invites the soul-searching you'd think it would. Instead, it all just somehow leads us to more smugness, more meanness, more certainty from reporters and pundits. Faced with defeat, we retreat further into our bubble. Assumptions left unchecked. No, it's the voters who are wrong. It's the voters. It's the Republicans. It's the other side. And in fact, there's more of these dangerous racists than we ever anticipated. And so that's the new narrative. Will Ron says here, as a direct result, we get it wrong with greater frequency. That's really the key point I want to stress here. Okay, you know about the biased media. You know how dishonest it's been. But look, they're just going to get it wrong. They're going to get it wrong with greater frequency. That's the grave danger here. Out on the road, we forget to ask the right questions. We can't even imagine the right question. We go into assignments too certain that what we find will serve to justify our biases. The public's estimation of the press declines even further. Fewer than 1 in 3 Americans trust the press. He says, finally here, there's a place for opinionated journalism. In fact, it's vital, but our casual, profession-wide smugness and protestations of superiority are making us unable to do it well. Our theme now should be humility. It should be humility. We must become more impartial, not less so. We have to abandon our easy culture of tantrums and recrimination. We have to stop writing these know-it-all 140-character sermons on social media and admit that as a class, journalists have a shamefully limited understanding of the country we cover. Well, that would be a good starting point for so many of them, to admit that they got it wrong and that they haven't covered the real story and that now they're just throwing a tantrum. One of our listeners sent me an email just this morning, saying that she watched this interview between this, I guess, this conservative actor, one of the few, who was supporting Donald Trump, and then two of the journalists that he had a discussion with. And this Trump supporter was pleading with the two to humble themselves, to just accept the outcome. And he even referenced a scripture in 2 Chronicles where it says that you should humble yourself and pray that God will hear you and heal the nation. That's from 2 Chronicles 7 in verse 14. I mean, she didn't say how these two journalists reacted to that man's admonition. Let me read for you what it says in that passage. Maybe we can read, if we have time, a few more verses here. 2 Chronicles 7 and verse 13. This is the Solomon here. It speaks in verse 12 about God appearing to Solomon by night. He's told Solomon, I've heard your prayer. And in verse 13 it says, if I shut up heaven, this is God, if I shut up heaven that there be no rain, or if I command the locusts to devour the land, or if I send pestilence among the people. I mean, if things go bad, if the curses come upon you, then how should you respond? What should be your response to this? He says, if my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face. That's the part of the verse that this Trump supporter put out there. But notice it continues, and turn from their wicked ways. See, that's part of the equation as well. Humbling ourselves before God and turning from our wicked ways. Then, God says, will I hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land. It's a wonderful assurance. A promise from God. The rain stops, the locusts devour the land, the pestilence sets in. Well, I suggest you humble yourselves and seek God and turn from wickedness and turn from sin. Verse 15, let's just continue reading. Verse 15 says, now my eyes shall be open and my ears attent unto the prayer that is made in this place. For now have I chosen and sanctified this house. Speaking of the temple that Solomon constructed, that my name, it says, may be there forever, and my eyes and my heart shall be there perpetually. See, look at what God will do for us if we remain humble and seek his will and turn from wickedness and turn from sin. In verse 18, it talks about God establishing this throne. God references or refers to the covenant that he made with David. This throne that would continue on even to this day. This Key of David message. This hope of the gospel. Verse 20. This is 2 Chronicles 7. Verse 20 says, then will I pluck them up by the roots out of my land which I have given them, and this house which I have sanctified for my name will I cast out of my sight, and I will make it a proverb and a byword among all nations. Well, I kind of skipped over some material there, but basically it's the same instruction that God gave to ancient Israel in Moses' day. Blessings come from obedience. If you forsake the ways of sin, if you humble yourselves and turn from sin, then you're going to be blessed. And yet if you turn to the ways of sin and transgression, then curses are going to come upon you. It's basic. It's a basic truth of the Bible. And it's a message that so many people don't want to talk about today. They don't want to listen. At least there was one, evidently, on one exchange, encouraging others to accept the result humbly and to turn to God. But together with that, we've got to forsake the ways of sin. Otherwise, the curses will intensify. Well, it says, verse 21, let me just see. And this house which is high shall be an astonishment to everyone that passes by it, so that he shall say, why has the Lord done this, done thus unto this land and unto this house? And it shall be answered. Verse 22, because they forsook the Lord God of their fathers, which brought them forth out of the land of Egypt, and laid hold to other gods, and worship them and serve them. Therefore has he brought all this evil upon them. That's why. That's the cause. All these problems, all these evils. Well, look at the problems that we're facing today. Ancient Israel, as you know from the history, eventually went into captivity, and Solomon's temple was destroyed. It was destroyed, and God had prophesied, we just read it, that he would make that house like a proverb or a byword. A byword. That's what it would become if the people of Israel turned to sin and disobedience. Well, you fast forward in the history, and of course the descendants of Israel, so many of them reside in the United States of America. As Herbert Armstrong proves in his wonderful book, The United States and Britain, in prophecy, and because of promises God made to Abraham thousands of years ago, back in the book of Genesis, going back to the early chapters of Genesis, God poured out blessings upon our peoples like no other nation, like no other people on earth in history. Great Britain, company of nations, as it says in Genesis, and then the single great nation that is the United States. At or around the year 1800, both of these peoples coming upon fabulous wealth and prosperity and power and strength. And even the leaders of these great nations, the great empire that was Great Britain or the United States of America, even the leaders early on and even midway through, in the case of Abraham Lincoln and others, even as recently as World War II, when you had leaders who acknowledged God's hand in our history, in these events. Well, we had leaders in America early on that likened America to New Israel. That's what they called it. God gave us this land, this promised land. What a blessing it is. Abraham Lincoln said, we didn't come upon these blessings because of our own ingenuity and strength. God gave these blessings to us. And well, like Herbert Armstrong covers in the United States and Britain in prophecy, once God fulfilled his promise, he made the promises to Abraham, promises of our national greatness and prosperity. And those promises, the fulfillment of them, they were postponed or put off for a period of many, many centuries, held off until the latter days. Ancient Israel, I mean, they never came upon all these fabulous blessings because of their sins. Our people in these latter days, we've been the recipients of all of these blessings, all of this prosperity, all of this power. And now we've squandered it away, and we see them disappearing. We see curses setting in, but there is hope. It's good to finish with this after a week like what we've had this past week over in Jeremiah 31. I'll just conclude here. Jeremiah 31 and verse 16, it says, "Thus says the Eternal, refrain your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears, for your work shall be rewarded, says the Eternal, and they shall come again from the land of the enemy, and there is hope in your end." There's hope in the end. I mean, all these problems and trials and curses and evils, it's building, as you know, it's building to what's described in Matthew 24, Great Tribulation. Jeremiah here, in the chapter previous to this, Jeremiah 30, it's referred to as the time of Jacob's trouble. Jacob's trouble, Daniel 12, a time of trouble like this world has never, never seen. That's Daniel 12 and verse 1. So many Bible prophecies show that America will be right there among nations that receive, well, unimaginable treatment during this great tribulation period. But there is hope. There is hope in the end. God promises that. The same Bible that prophesies of our fall, it also says there are bright days coming. There are. God, in fact, just as my father writes in his most recent book, God is going to make America great again. God's going to do it. No human leader's going to do this. And he is going to make Great Britain great again. From the very beginning, God said to ancient Israel, look, I want for you, it's not because I'm playing favorites here, but I'm giving you all of this. This special leadership, this arrangement, this place, this promised area, these blessings, this law, this perfect, holy, and righteous law, I'm giving it all to you so that you can be an example, a model nation, so that other nations can look to you and say, that's the way I want to follow. Look at the blessings that they've received. Well, God's going to set Israel up again, in the end, to be that model, that example, and then shower them, the people of Great Britain, the people of America, shower them with blessings. Yes, indeed, God intends to help us once again, in the end, to be that example he always meant for his people to be. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget about your weekend assignment, and that is to send in an email, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us all week. It's been a great week. Have a good weekend. We'll see you next week.